Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's visit today to the West Bank and his call for a Palestinian state and justice for the Palestinians. A former member of the Palestinian negotiating team, Rashid Halili, professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University and author of Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East, joins us to discuss Obama's meeting with the Palestinian president and his appeal for peace in an address to Israeli students. Then, in a follow-up to recent interviews on the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War, we will speak with a member of the CIA team that was pressured by Vice President Cheney to provide bogus intelligence in support of the build-up to the Iraq War about Saddam Hussein's non-existent WMD and his non-relationship with al-Qaeda. Former CIA analyst Nader Barkos joins us. She has an article at Wired, "I Tried to Make the Intelligence Behind the Iraq War Less Bogus." Then finally, we will speak with Max Richmond, the president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, about the letter he sent to President Obama today asking him about contradictions between his pledge on Social Security and recent contradictory statements on both the chain CPI and Medicare means testing that are apparently part of the White House's deficit reduction proposal. Joining us now is Rashid Halili, who is the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. His latest book is Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. And he has a recent article at the New York Times, Is Any Hope Left for Mideast Peace? Welcome to Background Briefing, Rashid Halili.
Thanks for having me.
And given that a week ago, in anticipation of the president's visit to Israel and to the West Bank, you know, you asked about any hope left. Do you have any more hope today, particularly after the president's meeting with the Palestinian president and his address to the Israeli students?
Not really. I don't think anything fundamental has changed. One of the things I argue in the book is that there's been a serious misapprehension of this president. Because for various reasons he was held in suspicion by some circles in Israel. I don't think people looked very carefully at his rhetoric and at his politics before he became president. He's a very cautious man. He's not a radical. He's very pragmatic. And he responds to the political terrain as he sees it, and that is what happened to him in his first term, first 4 years, as was the case with four of his five predecessors, everyone but George W. Bush. He tried to push back against some of the very tough Israeli positions on settlements in particular. And he failed because that was his read of the political terrain, both in the United States and Israel. His rhetoric, and I think the speech that he gave in Israel is a perfect example, echoes virtually every trope of the Israeli and Zionist narrative of reality. I don't think they could have asked for a better speech, frankly. There were a couple things about making peace and about settlements and about a Palestinian state, but those minor points aside, and I think they can be brushed aside, because American presidents have said similar encouraging things since President Carter, talking about a Palestinian homeland back in 1977. In practice, the United States continues to bankroll and support Israel as it continues to act in a way that makes a two-state solution absolutely impossible.
So, Rashid Halili, given that the president was speaking to the young Israelis, when he said the Palestinian people's right to self-determination and their justice must also be recognized, put yourself in their shoes, look at the world through their eyes. It is not fair that a Palestinian child cannot grow up in a state of her own, living their entire lives with the presence of a foreign army that controls the movements every single day. He's trying to obviously appeal to people's conscience in Israel. What's your response to that?
Well, he is, but I always say look at what they do rather than what they say. I think that's a lovely piece of rhetoric. You have to read the whole speech because there are literally dozens of paragraphs directed at reinforcing a variety of things that are very important to Israelis. And there is that paragraph and a couple of others that are meant to appeal to Palestinians. And I agree with you, reach out to Israelis and make them sympathetic. But what is being done and what the United States is not doing to stop it, I think, is much more important than this kind of talk, which we've been hearing from American presidents for several administrations. There is an inexorable process going on the ground, led by people who intend to prevent the possibility of a two-state solution. people in the Israeli Housing Ministry, people in the Israeli Defense Ministry, people in the planning of the roads and the bypass roads and the barriers and the walls and so on and so forth. If those processes aren't stopped, people can talk sweetly about the poor Palestinians and how they deserve a state until the cows come home, but it's not going to happen. Something has to be done to change a dynamic which is driven by people who are determined that a vision of the greater land of Israel, including most of the occupied territories, be imposed on the ground.
But surely there is another aspect to that, and that is the global position that Israel has. And the president did allude to that, saying, given the frustration in the international community, Israel must reverse an undertow of isolation. And it's pretty clear to me, since I was in Europe in the 60s, Israel was highly regarded in Europe, and now the reverse has happened. And but for the United States continually vetoing the UN, Israel would be completely alone. So at least there's some reality here in a global sense that the world is telling Israel to stop what it's doing and to get serious.
I think that's true, and I think that the president was very gently reminding the Israelis that but for the United States, they have nobody except Micronesia and three other tiny little countries like that that support what they do. And I think that that's important. There should hopefully be Israelis who understand that if they continue on this course, they will not just lose Europeans, as is, I think, slowly happening. They'll eventually be losing Americans, because what is being created on the ground, in practice, leave the words aside, is a reality. You can call it Jim Crow, you can call it discrimination, you can call it whatever you want. Some people call it apartheid. Whereby there are several classes of citizenship, with only Israeli Jews having full, complete, and absolute rights in the single state that is the only one that exists between the Mediterranean and the Jordan. That is the status quo. And unless something is radically something radical is done to change that status quo, I think that what the president has said to Israelis about the world is going to eventually apply to the United States. Americans right now are very supportive of Israel generally, but I think that if you look at younger people in this country, if you look at people who have access to the alternative media and so forth, they are a lot less accepting of some of the pieties that American politicians mouth unthinkingly than are their elders. And so I think the president's warning is well taken, but I think that in fact, the change that will really need to take place is in this country and eventually in Israel, because I think Israelis have shown that when they understand not just that they're isolated internationally, but that they're alienating American public opinion, they're likely to react in the right way.
Now, before he spoke to the Israeli students, on Thursday he went to the West Bank and met with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. But I think what's different there is that he seems to have abandoned the previous support for the Palestinian preconditions that settlement activity have to end before talks resume. He more or less said that this should not be used as an excuse to do nothing. So what's your take on that, Rashid?
Well, I don't really see these as preconditions. I think that anyone who continues the unlimited building of settlements in the occupied territories, as Israel has done under every prime minister since Begin, is clearly intent on an outcome in which is not negotiated, which is imposed. When I was an advisor to the Palestinian delegation to the Madrid and Washington peace talks from 1991 to 1993, the delegation was reassured by the fact that the United States had issued assurances to the Palestinians that the United States would oppose actions that predetermined, prejudged outcomes. And we went to the United States and told them, you know, the Shamir government is continuing to build settlements and is closing off Jerusalem from the West Bank. And Secretary Baker said to the Palestinian delegation, well, there's nothing we can do about it. And the delegation recommended to the PLO leadership, which was then in Tunis, that they really couldn't continue negotiations on that basis. If one side is eating the pie that the two sides are supposed to be negotiating the division of, that's not a negotiation. That is an imposed settlement. And that was 22 years ago that we made that recommendation. That process of nibbling, gobbling, or whatever you want to say, the pie. So to say this is a precondition, it is completely contrary to the spirit of the agreement that was signed on the White House lawn, that for 20 years Israel should be continuing to settle, continuing to separate Jerusalem from the West Bank and so forth. You cannot do those things and say that you're really interested in a two-state solution. You're interested in imposing a settlement on the Palestinians. That might be called a settlement. It's certainly not just peace.
Well, I guess the last time, though, there was a moratorium on construction, it took the Palestinians some time to get to the table before it expired, and then the talks went nowhere. So is this all to blame the Israelis? In other words, is there a problem on the Palestinian side?
There are many problems on the Palestinian side. I mean, the Palestinians are deeply divided. They don't have a clear strategy. They don't have a unified leadership. I mean, this is the weak party. This is the victim, actually. You know, this conflict is made out to be one between two equal parties or nearly equal parties. They're not. One is an occupation of the territory of the other. One has expelled half of the other people from its homeland. And one is a nuclear power, the third or fourth or fifth largest military state in the world. And in this situation, the Palestinians have to get their act together, have to unify, and have to have a clear strategy on how they want to approach things. I personally would say if I were in the position of a Palestinian leader, I would never negotiate on the basis on which negotiations are being offered. Negotiations have to be started on a clear basis, and that basis has to be a Palestinian state on the basis of the borders laid down in Security Council Resolution 242, which are the borders of 67 with some modifications. What has been imposed on the Palestinians is a whole series of preconditions going back to the Washington negotiations in Oslo, which I think have led us to where we are, to a status quo which is an impasse and which has clearly not produced peace. So we've had a process, but we have not had a peace process, a process that can lead to that two-state solution that people supposedly want. I, in fact, think it probably is too late to have that two-state solution, though things that have been done over these couple of decades probably could be reversed if the will were there. I just don't see the will, either in the Israeli political process or in the American political process, to deal with these realities.
So what will it take on the Palestinian side? People have talked about the need for a Palestinian Nelson Mandela, and that sounds fanciful to me. What's your prescription, Rashid Halidi?
Well, one thing, as I've just said, is the Palestinians have to unify their rights. The second thing they have to do is to get a clear understanding of how to approach this. I think that in these circumstances, violence gets the Palestinians, doesn't just get the Palestinians nowhere. It's actually a terrible hindrance to their cause. And as you could see from a very, I think, very perceptive New York Times Magazine article last Sunday, a lot of people in the West Bank have come to that conclusion, that the only kind of resistance that will work is nonviolent. And the third thing they have to do is to have a clear understanding of if they negotiate, what they're negotiating for. Negotiations for the sake of negotiations, negotiations to make the United States feel that it's doing something, that allow the Israelis to continue to get what they want, are not negotiations. They are, in fact, reinforcing a status quo which is harmful to the Palestinians. I wouldn't accept those kinds of negotiations. And I think that the entire process, which I myself participated in for a couple of years back in the early 90s, the entire process has been organized in such a way that it cannot lead to peace. So I would say all of those things are necessary for the Palestinians to play the role they have to play to solve their problems and to come to a resolution of this conflict. And we're a ways away from that. We're a ways away from the Arab world getting its act together. Democratic governance is still far away. Governments that represent their people are still far away. There may or may not be progress in that direction in some countries. But until you have governments that will tell the United States, our people will not put up with that. I mean, one of the strengths that Israel has is it can say, look, our Knesset says this, our public opinion says that. And it's very hard to go against that. Well, when you have democratic governments in the Arab countries, I think you're going to have a different situation as far as what America can, what the United States can say and do in terms of its own national interest. And in terms of, you know, a reluctance on the part of American policymakers to go against the democratic government. I mean, the Turkish government in the early 90s refused to allow the United States to use Turkey as a base for the war against Iraq. And there was nothing the United States could do. The military wanted to do it, the Turkish military. The Turkish government wanted to do it, but the parliament wouldn't go along. And that's an example of what I'm talking about. You don't have that kind of democracy in the Arab world. And until you do, I think it's going to be much harder for the Palestinians to negotiate, because they have no real support in the Arab world. The autocratic, weak governments, many of them completely dependent on Washington, are actually an asset to Israel and the United States in a negotiation, not an asset to the Palestinians.
But they're on their way out. I mean, that was, of course, the arrangements with Mubarak and others, and that's why the Israelis were alarmed at the Arab Spring. But you mentioned...
They're on their way out, Ian, but I don't think we're anywhere near stable democratic governance in those countries.
No, of course not.
Where we're going.
Right.
Some of those regimes are gone, but what will take their place and whether we'll have real democracies is an open question. Sorry, I interrupted.
No, not at all. I just wanted to mention that when you talked about the Palestinians adopting nonviolent protest, it reminded me of this very powerful film that was up for the Academy Award, Five Broken Cameras,
which
really does make that case. So,
as does another film that was nominated, The Gatekeepers, which talks about the absolute futility of what Israel has done over the past 46 years,
sure,
in the mouths of five heads of the General Security Services, of the Shabak, the Shin Bet. There are two eloquent testimonies to the same fact, one from the Israeli side and the other from the Palestinian side. Mm.
But in terms of the president talking today to the young Israeli students, it appeared to me, watching it, that almost all spoke English and were fairly probably the kids of the elite. There was one kid that was kicked out because he was protesting about the freeing the Americans who spied for Israel, Jonathan Pollard.
Pollard, yes.
But my question is, Israel is turning further and further to the right, particularly the younger generation, and it has a lot to do with the influx of refugees from the former Soviet Union, which Bill Clinton once mentioned and got yelled at for, and the fact, I think, that the media has become foxified, if you will, with people like Sheldon Adelson devoting an entire newspaper to his hero Netanyahu.
So, it's the largest circulation daily in Israel right now.
Right. So how do you combat that? And by the way, the same people who fund right-wing media in Israel, the same Americans, are the ones that also fund the West Bank settlements. So,
right. Irving Moskowitz, for example.
Yes, yeah. Out here at the Bicycle Club Casino, yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know how you deal with that. I would point out, though, that whatever the transformations that are taking place in Israel, Israel is in many ways dependent on the United States, and there are some interesting transformations in another direction that are taking place among young Americans and in the American Jewish community. I mean, in the last election, you had a unique situation where a Republican candidate was almost had the Israeli prime minister campaigning for him. And, you know, a vote for Romney was really a vote for Netanyahu. And it was very interesting to see how the American Jewish community split on that. It split 68-32 in favor of the president. They voted for Barack Obama, a man who was vilified by the right-wing press in this country and in Israel, as someone who was throwing Israel under the bus. And they voted, only 32% voted for Governor Romney. I think that that's an indication of where adults are. I think with young people, there's an even more interesting evolution, with a lot of college students and others beginning to be a little more questioning, a little more critical, a little more open-minded, even if they're, you know, still supportive of Israel or see themselves as Zionists. It's not your grandfather's or your father's campus anymore, where support for Israel is completely unquestioning whatever Israel does. Things are, I think, changing among the youth generally in this country as far as these issues are concerned. They don't trust the mainstream media. They don't trust the Murdoch press or Murdoch television. It's old white men who watch Fox. It's not young people who have all kinds of different attitudes. And on this issue, I think they're a lot more open-minded than their elders. And I think that's something that Israel, no amount of rebranding, no amount of PR, no amount of hasbara, no amount of basically distorting reality, which is what you have to do to sell some of these things, like settlements and occupation, is going to work with young people who distrust the mainstream media and politicians to begin with.
So when the president said, "But I want you to know that I speak to you as a friend who is deeply concerned and committed to your future," it sort of echoes in a way what a lot of critics have said about U.S.-Israel policy, which has been characterized as a policy of assisted suicide. Is he trying to make that point?
I'm not sure. I mean, I read the speech and I didn't see it as a number of other people did. He may well be trying to, you know, ingratiate himself with Israelis so that they will take on the message that he's trying to very, I think, subtly put forward, that they're going to really have to change a lot of things in order for there to be a resolution of this conflict. And it has to be resolved. The kind of blindness with which Israel seems to be rushing into imposing things on the Palestinians just ignores realities in the world, realities in the region, that the president, I think, very gently was trying to bring home to them. But I don't think there's a whole lot of time, frankly. I think a two-state solution may well be out of reach. And I think that the options thereafter are not really very good. for a vision of that a lot of Israelis seem to have, that they can impose certain things on their neighbors, and, you know, devil take the hindmost. Israel's a nuclear power. Israel's supported by the United States. Who cares what the rest of the world says? I don't think that kind of thing is going to work for very, very much longer.
So just in closing, in your article in the New York Times recently, Rashid Halidi, is any hope left for Mideast peace? You say that peace has to be made between Palestinians and Israelis, not between Mr. Obama and his critics in the Republican Party, the Israel lobby, and Israel's right-wing parties. If his speech fell on deaf ears and that the young are turning to the right in Israel and the opposite is happening here in the United States, is the president then, should he then campaign here in the United States?
Well, I would imagine that if he decides to devote energy to this, which he may or may not do, he's going to have to expend a little bit of his capital in the United States. Not so much convincing people, because I think the election was a sort of referendum on many, many things, but at least as far as this issue is concerned, as far as the vote of the American Jewish community is concerned, he won that referendum. But he's going to have to expend a little bit of capital in this country. I think that what he was telling Israelis is, first of all, I think it's worth going back and listening to the audio of that speech or watching it. These young Israelis may not be quite as right wing as you think, because there was a lot of applause for those passages in the president's speech where he was telling what were perceived as, I think, home truths to the Israelis about the Palestinians.
I'm suggesting, Rashid, that the country as a whole is moving to the right, and so
there's no question of that. There's no question of that. And I'm not sure how one deals with that, except telling Israelis you can't count on the United States support for some outrageous policies. And I would advocate that if I were, as an American citizen, I think we should really be pressing our government not to give Israel a blank check on its use of weapons in ways that violate U.S. laws in terms of use of those weapons for self-defense. I would press the government on things like donations going to so-called charitable organizations, 501c3s, which funnel money to illegal settlements populated by right-wing extremists who are carrying out attacks on Palestinians and doing things that are in violation of international law and U.S. policy. There are many things the United States can do. And tell the Israelis, you want to go ahead with these policies and these actions, go ahead. But the United States will not support them and bankroll them.
Well, Rashid Halidi, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Rashid Halidi, who is the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. His latest book is Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. And he has a recent article at the New York Times, Is Any Hope Left for Mideast Peace? We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a member of the CIA team that Dick Cheney was pressuring to provide bogus intelligence on Iraq.